Our speaker tonight shouldn't be any stranger to you. Peter's been a regular presenter to us on a wide range of topics, but this one in particular, I think, will be a very interesting one, given that it's now, 110 years and a couple of months since it actually occurred. So without further ado, would you please welcome Peter Witt to come and talk to us.
Evening, everyone. Thanks, Joe, for the welcome, and thank you all for coming along. I couldn't have predicted what was going to happen up in Samoa, but I might have attracted an audience anyway, because when I first submitted this, I made the title 2024 by mistake, so that would have been an interesting topic in its own right. But in respect to the Manawanui, and given that I'm serving in the military, I think Joe's probably said about him as much as is going to be said about that from up here anyway this evening. I really like this little campaign. It's I checked up at the library before while I was prowling around, and there are no books on it and on this particular campaign, and but there will be a couple of references. Peter Dennerly, naval historian, he's included some of it in a talk he gave, and then I ended up in papers around the First World War sort of naval engagement. And there's the Oxford University History of New Zealand sort of military, and there'll be a reference in there to the Samoa Expeditionary Force and its commander, Colonel Logan. But that's really about it in the public domain. And if anybody knows of any other sources, I'm happy to be corrected. But the New Zealand military history of the period is seriously balanced towards both Gallipoli and, of course, the Western Front. And I guess that's normal. And so really the Sinai-Palestine campaign is perhaps second fiddle, but way down the batting order is this one, Samoa, and probably the very small New Zealand contingent that served in Mesopotamia, Iraq, during the British campaign there, which ran for about 1914 to 1918. But anyway, I like this one because in 1914-15, you get a snapshot of exactly what it's like to take a group of New Zealanders overseas into the Pacific and see what happens. And all those things that happen to them are the same sorts of stuff that occurs on deployments. And we're going to go through hasty planning and boredom and hijinks and periods of panic and all that sort of stuff. But I also like this one because this is when New Zealand's first deployment, first not only of ever, but of the First World War, but we were in charge and also had to interact a lot with the Samoan population, which, previously, say, in South Africa in the Boer War, we were just part of a much larger British organisation, and we Australians and all the rest of them, we just fell in behind, but all of a sudden we were point of the spear. The other thing I'd say is this, and I know, recently Afghanistan, who would have thought it went on for 20 years? But who would have thought that group of servicemen there, sailors and soldiers, going ashore on 1914, who would have thought we'd still have people there 20 plus years later? And indeed, that the war would go on until 1918. And so again, there are so many parallels to the modern era. It's, it would be great, but I don't think the New Zealand Defence Force is any better informed about this particular operation than anyone else, really. But, it was, and I've just pinched from the title this cable which is in diplomatic speak, if you've worked with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the way the language comes out, sure, if you feel yourselves able to see Samoa, then you'll go ahead. An urgent imperial service, so don't dilly-dally. But there's that interesting sentence at the end, that any territory occupied will be at the disposal of the imperial government. But a little reminder to the New Zealanders that whilst we might be doing this urgent and important service, we wouldn't or weren't supposed to then have it fall into our realms. Well, certainly in advance of any British interests that there may have been. Well, Samoa, or Western Samoa, as it was until the name change in 1997, is an independent and democratic state. And indeed, as Joe mentioned in the introduction, you know, they're hosting Chogham right now as we meet here. So it's interesting then that Robert Louis Stevenson had, probably about 130 years ago, and certainly before the events we're going to discuss, had this message for the chiefs in Samoa. He had witnessed a lot about colonisation, and he realised that, in fact, he told the Samoans that if they didn't start using their land and that, then he basically implied that they would lose it to other imperial powers. So what I'm going to do, and this is the official, if you like, history of the Expeditionary Force, copy found, thank you Joe, on your website, and it paints a pretty rosy, positive view of the campaign, but it's basically the main source, even out of archives, so it really glosses over if there are any kind of lumpy bits, and really is from the perspective of New Zealand and the British Imperials, as opposed to, say, what Samoans might have thought at the time, or indeed the Germans or anybody else. So that's where the main source material is, and I'll basically use that just to go through. We'll back up the clock to see when Samoa was settled, and we'll work our way through to the end of the occupation of the Expeditionary Force in 1915, when they withdrew. There's then a transition, which I won't really cover in any detail, to the relief force, which in turn transitioned to a kind of an occupation force, was military, became a civil administration. And in that, I'll just mention a couple of incidents that occurred that tend to have coloured Samoa's view of New Zealand in that time, and possibly cast a shadow on the previous years, certainly of 1914 and 1915. And I will talk about the experiences, albeit briefly, of some of the men that were members of the force, or the men and women in the force, but I'll talk about just some of the men that went on. So no one really knows for sure when Samoa was first inhabited, but it's generally thought at about 1000 or so BC or BCE, and it's really part of the eastwards migration, probably out of somewhere like Taiwan, coming down through the Malay Peninsula, what we now know as the Philippines, and spreading eastwards across the Pacific. And of course, at a point in time, out of Hawaiki, that kind of circled area underneath the 1000 CE there, that's the group of those same migrants who would eventually hook back and populate New Zealand. So the Samoans have, you know, their origins are, I guess, the same as Maori, to a point where they've come eastwards across the Pacific in the tropical latitudes there. You'll note, and I'm not going to discuss it, the Tongans invade for a period, and also there are internal battles amongst Samoans, and just like in New Zealand, you know, useful ground becomes quite valuable and it would be fought for, so there had been some fighting there. But it's 1522, Magellan ships have come into the Pacific, and pretty much Roggeveen is the first of the Europeans to sight what's becomes Samoa. But it's de Bougainville who calls Samoa initially the Navigator Islands, and he does this because he comes across Samoans way, way off the coast, well away from the islands, and he deduces that they must be really good navigators if they can find their way back home. And he is correct. But so that was their initial name. There are other expeditions, but I mentioned De La Perouse. I think I've got that right. With the picture there, you can see the Papalagi, the skybreakers, the Europeans that have broken through the sky or the horizon of the world that the Samoans knew and have got themselves into the Samoans' world there. So they're the skybreakers. And this is an incident where there's a bit of an altercation when La Perouse lands, but the next day, even worse, 12 Frenchmen are killed and 39 Samoans. And this is, like New Zealand, where the Europeans have the musket, of course, so they, you know, 3-1 on the casualties there. There were other incidents, but to a degree, Samoa got a reputation as a bit of a trouble spot. But eventually Europeans start to settle in Apia, and the initial ones, a bit like Kororareka, but not quite so bad. But there's a lot of the drifters, the escaped convicts, the ship jumpers and that sort of thing. But eventually it's the great powers of the day that become interested, and specifically the United States, Germany and Britain. They actually fight, and they're supporting and supported by different Samoan factions. And so you have these civil wars. And the cover of this book, which I have not read, and I don't think it's in the library, I just found that on the internet. I like the picture because what happened was two nations were about to fight over Samoa and have an engagement with their cannons against each other's ships when this storm came in, and you can see the effect there. That pretty well put an end to the conflict and the fighting. Everybody turned to dealing with the aftermath and the impact on the locals, and out of that we ended up with the Treaty of Berlin being signed. The outcome was that the Americans got what we now know as American Samoa, and Pangapanga, I guess is the right pronunciation for that city there. The Germans got the two big islands of Samoa with Apia and that in it, and the British got other areas in lieu, so they didn't actually get any part of Samoa. The Germans established a formal colonial government with a governor overseeing the administration, and this is just like New Zealand in that respect, only not Germans. They developed infrastructure, roads, ports. They promoted the cultivation of cash crops, particularly copra. And things were going quite well, but I think with the locals, once they realised that the wealth or the economy was heading more towards the Germans or the Europeans, that was a cause for dissatisfaction. The Germans had allowed some local customs to continue, but more and more they brought their own their own values and systems, and we know about that here. You can see there's the armed forces, and I think if you look in there, you'll see some of them will be local men. So that's kind of a German empire, not huge on a scale of, say, France or Britain, but there, and just to drill in a little bit further, this is the part of the Pacific we're interested in. So whilst the map says occupied by the British, that's us, New Zealand, and then a couple of other areas were occupied later by Australians in September, New Guinea, and then later in December, Bougainville and the Marshall Islands. So quite quickly in December, the aim was to oust the Germans or remove the Germans from that part of the world. The governor of Samoa in 1914, the last one, of course, was this Dr. Eric Schultz-Ewerth. His defences, well, that maybe a native constabulary was first thought. Perhaps a number of Germans of military age, but there was not a lot known about the state of the defences on the island itself. And I just put that little note there, you know, this idea that New Zealand was directed to the old almanac. Apparently not so. But nevertheless, there wasn't a lot of information really known about the country. The real threat was posed by von Spee's German East Asiatic Squadron, basically out of Tsingtao, or Qingdao, I think it's called nowadays, on the coast of China, way up by Korea. And he had a number of ships, but they are the five big ones there, particularly the Scharnhorst and the Nice. Now, these were armoured cruisers, and so they not only did they have the most powerful guns, but they had the strongest armour. And the fleet, because it couldn't be tracked accurately, you were reliant on out-of-date reports and sightings and stuff like that. You could only guess at them, so they were kind of the bogey. So one thought was that what if they intercepted the New Zealand fleet while it was at sea? You know, troop ships, that kind of thing. What if before the New Zealanders got there, or shortly after they did, those ships were able to land sailors or marines and set up some sort of defence or counterattack? And then what if following the landing the Germans came and did a landing themselves and tried to take it back? I mean, they didn't know what the possibilities were, only that the German fleet was very powerful and that the fleet was well aware of Apia, and that's the fleet before the war in the Apia harbour there, with the Scharnhorst as the one kind of right in the middle up the back there with the four funnels. So they were a threat, and this drove a lot of the things around the need for speed, but also the need for secrecy and security, because you didn't want to tip off the Germans where we were heading. So I just put this up there. I'm not a great one for timelines, but this is an incredibly quickly mounted military operation. On the 6th, some people say, or certainly on the 7th, depends on your date lines, you get the cable that I just showed you earlier from the UK. Cabinet approves the force. The troops are all on parade on a Friday night anyway, so they're all in their posts in Auckland and Wellington and elsewhere, about to do some drill for the night, so they're quickly enlisted. The weekend was spent examining people medically, enlisting them, getting them equipment, and then pretty much Monday and Tuesday they've assembled the force down in Wellington. I think Wellington was selected because of the port, and it was just easier to make use of the railway network to move the number of people and stuff down there rather than try and get everybody up the other end to Auckland. And the force they actually embarked on the ships on the 12th. They got off again and did a parade, weather and all that sort of stuff, but they left on the 15th. That is really quick. You know, even large deployments that I've been on, we're talking weeks, you know, not for some of the special ones, they can be done in very short order. Afghanistan was one, I think, the recovery there. But for this scale, that's an incredible timeline. And there we are, just for you, Joe, the railway engineers on parade in Wellington on the 11th of August, all good to go. And that's a large number of people. And within that will be not only locomotive drivers and stokers and all that sort of thing, but engineers, plus those that can lay track, level it all out, run the signals, all that sort of stuff. So quite the group. A lot was going on. So on the left, that's from Papers Past. That just shows some of the Palmerston North contingent. They were picked up by train that was coming out of Napier. And apparently wherever the trains left and came down through Palmy or down through the main trunk, every town had people out waving, bands were playing and cheering. It was quite the procession to get...
Fully in secret then.
Yeah.
Oh, well, you know, no, that's a good point. So it was no secret that a force was being raised. I mean, war was declared. And at the same time, New Zealand was mobilising the expeditionary force that would end up in the Middle East. So the cover story for this one was that it was the advanced force of that. So... yeah, they were mobilising, but to all intents and purposes, they were being mobilised to go to Europe.
Yeah.
Yeah? So, that, you know, and you know, there was lots of patriotism, all that sort of thing. The German consulate, of course, firmly closed. They used the word sealed up. And down the bottom, there were a number of Germans living in New Zealand, and they were also rounded up, and many of them ended up on Soames Island. So that's sort of the group of people. It's not an infantry battalion. It's not an engineer regiment, Joe. It's not an artillery thing. It's really the sort of force they felt would be useful stuck on its own in the islands. So the headquarters, sure, there's three infantry companies, one from Auckland, two from Wellington, with their machine guns as well as their men. There's a small artillery battery, two Mark IVs and two of the Nordenfeldt guns. There's a company of field engineers, but then there's another company of railway engineers, and I'll talk about those. There was medical, nursing, chaplains, signals detachment so they could work the wireless. The Post and Telegraph Company of New Zealand provided a few bods to work that. The Army Service Force, the Corps, Royal Navy, and motorboat mechanics to operate the boats that were going to take the men ashore, and then, of course, the band went along from Marum. They all had to be, apparently, infantry trained, so they weren't just going to go to play music, so they had a particular role. And indeed, nowadays, you know, the band is kind of a stretcher bearer organisation. And there's Colonel Robert Logan, who was appointed the commander, and stayed on. Once the force returned to New Zealand and replaced by the relief force, he remained on as the governor there. Oh, and that's that point that you dug out. Essentially, they were known as the Advanced New Zealand Force, so that the destination of Samoa couldn't be known. There was a lot of speculation. Oh, somewhere tropical. Maybe Australia. Maybe Europe. You know, but for those that got into the force, the aim was to get in and see action. They wanted to go to war, and so they were wanting to move real quick, but the higher ups were wanting to conceal the actual destination for the reasons I explained with the German fleet. So Logan gets his instructions. Clearly he's to seize the islands, and then the wireless station is to be, and I'll talk about that in a moment, his primary objective. You'll note paragraph 5 is quite subtle, because what it's saying there is that the Navy will protect you on the way, but it's not going to hang around. It itself doesn't want to get trapped in and around Samoa by the German fleet, but it's also got other jobs to do, taking others away to Europe via the Middle East. And then number 6, and we'll talk about the measures that were introduced by there, and then, of course, the wireless station. So there's the secret instructions that he got basically 2 days prior to sailing. The voyage, the 1,300 or nearly 1,400 people are crammed onto those two ships there, the Moraki and that, and they are dining in four sittings. They're in the holds, four bunks high, and the holds as well are crammed with all the equipment and stuff that they need. It is a real shamozzle. But the decision was taken that they would head off, and the original plan was that they would go to Fiji direct. But the three ships, the Psyche, the Philomel, and the Pyramus, which towed just shortly after they left the Wellington Harbour, was decided to be too small a fleet, so they were actually diverted to New Caledonia, where they met up with a number of other ships that would escort them to Fiji and then onwards to... So no shore leave in New Caledonia, and into Fiji, and then a very short time later they get to Samoa. So in Caledonia they were joined by the battle cruiser Australia, the light cruiser Melbourne, and a French ship called the Montcalm. So you've now got serious warships accompanying the troop ships, which you don't want to come into contact with the German fleet. And the other interesting point about the stop in Fiji was that they picked up the Fiji Legion of Frontiersmen, and they also got about 14 Samoan men who were working in Fiji to accompany them, and so they could, when they got to the island, they would send them through the two main islands to send the word that, look, hey, we're coming here just to take this off the Germans, we mean you no harm. So they thought about that as well. When they were on the journey, they didn't have a firm plan about what they were going to do when they got there. And there were various options about landing in different parts of the island and then converging on up here. Do you all land in the one spot? Do you land in a couple of different spots? What do you do? But by the time they got to New Caledonia and talked it out with the British, with the warship COs there, then when they got to Fiji, they were able to finalise the plan. And essentially the plan was that the warships would basically guard out the entrance to Apia. Then the sailors would then be taken in, and you see a group of them there because this is the actual plan. The landing party would go ashore under a white flag with a message calling on the governor to surrender. So, if he did, all over, no worries, they'd just proceed. But if there was no response, or indeed there was either a ship in the port, a German one, or shooting started, then the warships would come in, there'd be a bombardment, and then they would land. But, as you can see, the officers went ashore. Although the governor wasn't present at the time, gone up the wireless station, I think. They waited for about an hour. A message came back, and I'll just read it here, saying something along the lines of, though we cannot surrender the territory, no resistance will be offered to the landing, and orders have been given to pack up the wireless station. So that was it. So essentially, meanwhile, one of the Australian ships has cleared, made sure the harbour is clear of mines, and then the launches and these kind of surf boat, lifeboats are lowered. The men scramble down on nets, and then they're towed in strings of boats, and then finally they just row in the last part, and you can see them coming ashore. It's probably just as well. This is what Governor Schultz said afterwards. So maybe 20 soldiers and some special constables and a once-a-week fired ceremonial gun. That was about the state of the defences. So I think it was a good call on the part of the force not to go in there with guns blazing and assume the worst. Right. You know, they took the precaution of making sure there was no German warship in port, and then came in and asked for the surrender. Although they did threaten to use force if surrender wasn't forthcoming. The landing went ahead. Groups of soldiers principally, got ashore and secured all the main points. The local police were rounded up and then quickly released on bail so they could do their duties. They got in all horses, all vehicles, the few that were there, commandeered those. And then a detachment of Auckland infantry with some engineers and others headed off, and signallers headed off to get that all-important wireless station. And you can just see them starting to land there on the island. So the wireless station, that's it there, Telefunken. So led by a guide in the dark up through the bush to the cleared area at the top of the hill where the wireless station was located. They overpowered the guards. I'm not sure if the guards were armed or what, but nevertheless they were overpowered. And then when they got there, the New Zealanders found that parts of one of the governors had been removed, but a lot of the wires had been disconnected but reconnected, and you know, to confuse the operation. But worse, there was a suspicious wire that led down under the floor to a battery and a whole lot of explosives that were set up by the radios, the floor and the engine room. So it could have gone pretty seriously wrong there, but fortunately they were cautious and they were able to get eventually the wireless sort of set up. And you can see on this map the distances why Samoa being central was good for the German fleet and from a communications point of view, and then just using that kind of 1,200 miles, say 2,000 kilometres as a general reference, and just that's kind of the radius that you could think that the wireless would be able to operate to, and they got it going. Although a flag was raised on the day, the official raising of the flag occurred there. The Psyche fired a 21-gun salute, and then a proclamation was read, and they're the key points there. So all occupants to obey the occupying force, no communications with Germans, there was a curfew was imposed, public meetings were prohibited, you couldn't print a newspaper or a circular, no alcohol to be produced or distributed. German officials, and this is pretty good, who wanted to retain their posts in the government could do so on notification to the governor, the new governor. Vehicles were all, and then of course any arms were supposed to be handed in, and there was a copy of it also in Samoa as well. I mean, in hindsight, they seem pretty draconian, but if you've just arrived there, you've got to explain what the rules are going to be, because you don't want any trouble to break out, and you need to have some rules there. This, I'm just going to go through some of the reactions, but I quite like this one. In the back right is Trooper, or maybe Private Bailey. He was one of the ones picked up in Fiji, joined the force from Fiji and accompanied them, and I think he's the one that captured that German flag. Now, local reaction was pretty much, they'd experienced this sort of thing before, was to head away from Apia in the expectation that with the British or the, you know, the warships there, there'd be some sort of bombardment. Australia's reaction was to express alarm that news of the landing had made it into the paper. And I think if we think about that timeline going back to the islands that they were going to be taking in September, they would be worried that something like this might provide a bit of a tip-off. They clearly knew it was happening at the official level, because they released, you know, their own ships. The expats, not the German ones, but the British and the Belgian ones, all wrote it. They wrote a letter to Colonel Logan and asked that Dr. Schultz, the governor, be treated well, because he treated them well since the outbreak of the war. Governor Schultz, he wrote to Colonel Logan protesting about being arrested or taken prisoner and bundled aboard a troop ship. with no time to really sort out his affairs and taken off the island. And whilst he asked for special rights and privileges, it seems to me when the way he and the other German prisoners were treated on Motuhee, they all got pretty right royal treatment until one von Luckner a few years later made his escape, and then things tightened up a bit. And there's another letter, I didn't copy it, where he's asking for his servant to be released and sent down to New Zealand as well. Thank you very much. So the German prisoners, and this is only from Motuhee, a lot of the Germans that had been living in New Zealand were sent to Somes Island, and they were treated pretty roughly in quite basic conditions, and maybe there were beatings and a lot of rough treatment. And whereas the ones at Motuhee were much better treated, and possibly the first commandant who took them at their word, you know, this is probably what allowed von Luckner to escape. But nevertheless, you can see all the government officials are there, not only the governor, but many of the surveyors and the government clerks. So that's not all German public servants, but a good deal of them have been taken from Samoa and detained. A number of civilians, bankers, merchants, planters, a railway technician, they've all become prisoners as well and confined in Motuhee. But the sailors, the young officers from the Elsass, that was a commercial ship that was in port in Pango Pango when war was declared. The ship was interned, and so they made their escape to Apia in the expectation of joining von Spee's fleet, but of course it had been already taken by the New Zealanders, so they went straight into the bag. And that bad luck probably ultimately actually saved their lives, because, as I'll point out, the bulk of von Spee's fleet was sent to the bottom a few months later. So there was quite a group. That's not all I just grabbed the group out of the Motuhee off Samoa. So the occupation, it sort of settled into a routine. 4:30, everyone would be up, standing to, so they had pre-prepared battle positions in case there was going to be a landing, trenches, blockhouses, all that sort of thing, things to do. Then they'd be stood down once the patrols had returned to make sure no crafty Germans had landed and snuck up and were going to pounce on the wireless station or Harpier or something like that. And, you know, they got into a lot of routine work. It was very hot, and apparently the locals' shops that are roaring trade in shorts and singlets. You can see some of that there. And there's the headquarters group, the staff there. And some nurses, of course. One of the nurses, she was also in Fiji and joined the expedition. She'd been stranded there and joined and went up and presumably returned to New Zealand, taking the long route through Samoa to get all the way back in 1915. Almost as soon as the force arrived, repatriations to New Zealand began. This is quite common. It seems that in that party of 70, there were a number of men who'd refused the typhoid inoculation they were going to get on the way up. They were instantly, right, you're going home. And then a number of other men were found to be unfit or unwell or unsuited, and they were sent home. So thereafter, every other month when ships came up, they would take back the sick, the lame, the lazy. And then more increasingly, they were starting to take out the fighting men and officers who would then be diverted, sometimes to their British regiments and other times to New Zealand units, and they would go off to Gallipoli and to the Western Front in the main. So there were quite a lot of repatriations where there were ships running backwards and forwards on an infrequent basis. So then the German fleet reacted, so 2 weeks after the landing. So in the meantime, all the warships have gone pretty much the day after the landing. And the rumours of the whereabouts of the German fleet were rife. Sentries were posted on different parts of the island and up on the wireless station at the port looking out. And at night there were lots of false alarms because the Samoans were going out onto the reef at night with lights to do their fishing. So the soldiers were being stood to all the time. But on the morning of the 14th of September, it was pretty obvious that some steady lights were coming off from a distance. And at first light, you know, the men had been stood to, gone to their battle positions, and even as the Shan horse and the knees now came into the port and were basically rigged for action, ready to fire, in case maybe they discovered British warships or something in there. But there was no firing. The men had been instructed to hold their fire and only to fire if there was a landing. But it seems Von Spee, on seeing the Union flag flying, decided that actually he wouldn't bombard because he didn't know if there were any German citizens left there, so he didn't want to kill any of them. And so they went, much to the relief at that point, no doubt, to the occupation force. They departed, but they did go to Papeete, where they bombarded the town, killing five of the townspeople and sinking also a French gunboat before heading further east towards South America. And when you look at it, I think Spee has decided that probably the German, you know, territory in the Pacific's not worth saving. So his aim really is to get down to the Cape Horn, get around the bottom if he can, and then get up through into the Atlantic and basically join the main fleet to fight the British at this point in time, or the Allies. So that's what they do. So they provided a little bit of excitement for a day, or for at least a morning. It was always possible, but simply because the rules of engagement of the New Zealanders were not to fire unless there was a landing, and Spee's decision not to fire simply because of the possibility of German nationals prevented any bombardment and any firing. And I don't know how much damage those four artillery pieces might have done, but it would have been a better thing that there was no fighting. So this is a group of railway engineers. They called themselves the Workers. The Germans had made a railway line up to the wireless station, and these guys, they built other tracks around the place, and trains became the main way of getting about. In fact, they were so popular that there was a regular timetable produced, and a Sunday outing for the troops on leave was to take the train up to the wireless station. You know, when you're in the tropics, you go up a bit higher and it's actually quite cool up there, so they probably enjoyed that. The railway engineers had to pretty much cobble together the one train that existed and make it serviceable along with all the track and stuff, and then they decided that there was the schedule of trains and the movement of stores, equipment and men was so heavy that they needed another one, and they found an old engine, and then some engineering was kind of converted that into a kind of a locomotive, and so they basically had two trains to run all the stores and people around and all that sort of thing. So that's got one description of the occupation. But another thing they had to do was, because the people were under German law and all that sort of thing, they allowed the Germans to stay in their positions, but they found that they were still using the old Imperial German seal on basically signing off documents as if the German government was still in charge. So they kind of got moved out. And a lot of members of the Samoa force ended up being inducted into the civil service there. So for the period of the time they were in the civil service, they were basically discharged from the army so that they could be civilians doing their roles there. And there was a gentleman, a British, Mr. Richard Williams, who'd already been the administrator there for a number of years. He was quickly put into position and stuck on the other main island. So there was a little bit of continuity there, though I've got to say, soldiers probably don't make really good administrators for customs, the treasury, lands and survey, justice, that sort of thing, but there were still people in those positions. If the presence of the ships and the possibility of fighting was a prompt or some sort of an incentive, I think after a while, especially when they knew that many New Zealanders were already in the Middle East, became a bit of a, there was some sort of war weariness. There was lots of rain, tropical downpours, many mosquitoes, but no mosquito nets. Water parties, wood gathering parties were sent out. So the life of a soldier often becomes one of doing a lot of fatigues or work parties. There was insects aplenty, the heat I've mentioned, and for periods of time there was monotonous and inadequate food. And some of that was because of the heat. A lot of food was actually going off and had to be thrown out, so you know it could be pretty tough at times. But apart from the band, the news of the destruction of the fleet was received in the middle of the night. But the word quickly passed, and apparently there was shouting, cheering, lamps were lit, people jumped up out of bed and half clothed or half naked, whatever it was, all rushed in towards town, and there was kind of like partying and all that sort of thing there, where they celebrated the destruction of the two ships and the rest of the German fleet that had basically been their nemesis there. And at the Battle of the Falkland Islands, the bulk of the German fleet and Spee himself were lost. The other matter, which according to the history is the, quote, the one and only serious disciplinary breach in the Forths, occurred at Christmas. A rumour, and rumours abound during deployments, so, you know, the role of officer, you know, just to try and quell those, but there had been a rumour that one of the three hotels, which were all out of bounds, was actually going to open on Christmas Day. Christmas. So the men all went into town. The owner of the hotel confirmed that, in fact, this was not the case. And whereupon the men basically broke into the hotel and relieved of it all its contents. And furthermore, they broke into the two other hotels and relieved them of their contents too. So the Central, Tivoli's and International hotels all had all their alcohol stocks removed.
Cool confiscation.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And apparently there was an inquiry to work out who, and that never went anywhere, but for weeks afterwards, in the middle of the night, there'd be a whole lot of laughing and carrying on as the soldiers had taken away their stocks of alcohol and hidden them in the different plantations and would sneak off there at night and have a quiet drink. They worked out there was something like 180 pounds worth of lost alcohol, and the commander just levied the entire group. That was how the hoteliers were paid back. So, you know, it became, I think, for the men, somewhat of a, it was really exciting to go. They wanted to go. The tropical conditions were difficult, but for them, the great disappointment was, in fact, the war was moving on without them, and they felt that they probably would miss out, and that started to impact on morale. And just like a reverse, deaths, casualties can have an impact on a contingent's morale. So too can the fact that you're kind of overlooked or that you're maybe missing out on the action. And it was made even more difficult for the men that were still there. And the force number was slowly dwindling down when certain people were being selected and sent back to New Zealand specifically to go on active service. So it was with some relief then that in March, a Samoa relief force was sent up, 300 initially, to send up to replace by 300 men who were either unwell or unfit or actually destined to go to the front. And then basically on the 3rd of April, the Samoa relief force arrived and there was a handover between the two contingents, and the remainder of the expeditionary force returned to New Zealand. the relief force was by and large made up of men in the main and some women, but they were those who, particularly their age, meant that they were not going to be required or sent to either the Middle East or to Europe. And that group stayed there for a number of years. Well, there would have been reinforcements and rotations and all that sort of business, but essentially the Samoa Expeditionary Force left in April at about the same time, or shortly before another group of New Zealanders were landing in Gallipoli. But Colonel Logan, he remained on as the governor there. So the men were desperate to go to a war. They thought perhaps that they might have got that in Samoa, but they did not, for reasons that we've discussed. So the two down the bottom, both killed in action. So they both killed pretty much during the August offensive. So they've arrived there, probably missed the Gallipoli landing, but they've gone in as reinforcements. So on the 8th and 9th respectively, Robinson and Robbie are both killed there. And up the top, Ricketts and Robinson are both, well, one's killed in action in 1916 and the other dies of wounds in 1917. In all, in the book, doesn't give you the numbers, so I had to count the photos, but according to my count of the members of the force, 44 were killed, died of wounds or died of sickness. And, you know, sickness is as had been the case in South Africa, also a big killer. So there were just four of 44 who ended up getting the action that they wanted, but not the outcome. What struck me, though, with the nominal role, which they've included here, is the high proportion of men that returned who went on to serve mainly in the Middle East, but sometimes in ANZAC, and the high proportion of private soldiers, NCOs as well, who were commissioned, and others that got, here we go, military medals, military crosses. Some people joined the Royal Flying Corps. I mean, they, by and large, they got those that were fit well enough. They got to the main war, and as a group, you can say that they did pretty well. In fact, I judge their deployment as a successful one, and I would do that looking at it militarily, rather than perhaps from the perspective of maybe the local population. And specifically, I think the New Zealand occupation is coloured by the fact that the ship, the Talumi, sailed from Auckland during the epidemic, and we know now about epidemics and the effect that happens when, and 8,500 Samoans died, you know, 20% of the population. And the New Zealanders, who were now in control as the authorities allowed that ship to come in without going through the quarantine protocols and the flu, pretty much decimated the population. And it was made worse by the fact that Colonel Logan, although he had been offered support by the Americans from Pango Pango, never took it up, and I don't know why not. Look, I don't have too much of an explanation of why. Was it Colonel Logan himself or other officials? But nevertheless, it had a devastating effect on the people of Samoa. Samoa had a rocky road to independence, so after the war, it was New Zealand was granted trusteeship of the island, so remained in charge there. And just like was established in New Zealand, there was a British colonial model with an administrator and ran the business there. But we see the rise in about 1927 of the Mau, or the Ole Mau Samoa, the Firm Opinion of Samoa, or the Maus, kind of a resistance group, really peaceful resistance in the main, but made worse in 1929 when a number of the Mau, or a number of Samoans really, were killed by New Zealand police during a parade, maybe a protest or something in downtown Apia, and another 50 wounded. And so, you know, this has left a bad memory, and it's kind of coloured, if you like, the original deployment that we've been talking about there. So a bad moment, and you know, even New Zealanders sort of head off into the bush to try and track the Mao down, but they're very unsuccessful. Then in 1962, rather, Samoa gets independence, and then changes its name, as I mentioned earlier, to 1977. I'm not going to talk about any of that in detail, and I don't have the detail to answer sort of detailed questions, but you can kind of see, you know, New Zealand was on the road and was perhaps a bit of a stumbling block at times towards its path to independence. So just to kind of conclude, and that's there's 11 graves. I think one of them is an officer, a pilot from World War II, but the other 10 are New Zealanders. They are all from none of them are from the expeditionary force. They're all from the relief force. And when I tracked down, the first death was Private Ure, aged 55, who accidentally was killed falling off a balcony somewhere on the island. Three of the others that died of disease were aged 45, 48 and 48. So what we're seeing, as I mentioned, is the relief force is essentially the older men who are not going to be sent to the Western Front or to Europe, and they end up being in the force here. Private Ure is interesting. I was able, because he was killed, to look up a few details. He actually sailed up in the Talumi ship, and when he came up on the relief force, this is the same ship that, of course, a few years later brought up the virus. So even though there's graves there, they were not killed in action or anything or anything like that. Basically, other than the first one I mentioned who died of an accident, the rest was all of an illness. Just sort of concluding things then, you know, even though there was no fighting, there was a perceived threat, and almost came to fruition with the arrival of the German warships. But I think the whole thing, you know, in terms of the way it was so quickly cobbled together, and then the way they went in without all guns blazing, was done well. And they overcame the booby traps on the wireless station. They set the defences up, and even when the warships arrived, they seemed to, you know, keep their courage up. But thereafter that, especially after the destruction of the German fleet and the realisation that war was probably passing them by, this impacted really on the morale and all the rest of it. And even in the modern era, this is why it's really important for NCOs and officers to be on top of things and making sure that people don't switch off, whether it be through boredom or whatever else, or just, you know, routine. So there's quite a lot out of this operation, this New Zealand operation, the first one, New Zealand's first one and first of the First World War, that's quite useful when you look back on it. You know, it's arguably one of, if not the most forgotten of the New Zealand First World War campaigns. And if you just take the expeditionary group part and leave out the business later on with the influenza and the Mao, then up to, certainly during the First World War, it was, in my view anyway, from a military point of view, quite a successful operation and fulfilled the mission that Logan had been given and that the British wanted from their urgent service. So with that, they're the main references that I use. So as I say, there's not a lot written about it. Even James Cowan's book's got about a chapter on the campaign. It's really more of a history of Samoa. But that's it. I'm more than happy to take questions or comments. Thank you. Thank you.
the members of the force qualify for Pacific Star?
That's Second World War. There was no.
There was no campaign sort of medal there.
And, you know, this is also part of it. And then those members of the force, you know, compared to everything that went on in Gallipoli and the fact that often they went, it was kind of like, oh, well, you know.
Yeah, but they would have got the normal two.
Yes, correct.
Pipsqueak, farewell. Yeah, as the medals were called. The victory medal.
At least you got your name on, not like the Second World War, yeah.
Yeah, that's a whole new thing. There's quite an interesting discussion on naming and not naming of medals, so yeah.
Any other questions?
Probably just a little bit. Some of the stuff that I did when I did my thesis was involving the people going up from around here, just your German. So sons of German immigrants who could speak the language and they went up. I'm pretty sure they were operating the radio or listening in on the radios to see what came in from wherever.
Yeah, I think eavesdropping or electronic warfare in its infancy there, you use the linguists that you've got.
Yeah.
And that would have been important to try and ascertain communications.
Guy Wallerman, I think he was
one of them. The German squadron on its way to its destruction off the Falklands destroyed a Royal Navy squadron at Coronel off Chile.
So I think there Spain would have been trying to neutralise the threat, but of course the destruction of that fleet led to his own, and that then caused the British to send a couple of dreadnoughts down, which Spey didn't know about, to the Falklands, and he got basically.
And it's interesting that those ships, you know, the new ships in World War II were named Scout Horse, Knees Now, Grass Bay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so yeah, there's a bit of history of that too.
But I think the naval war, whether it be U-boats and submarines or. These sort of things are really interesting topics in the First and the Second World War, because it's a lot of cat and mouse sort of stuff, and even the merchant ships flying, or the troop ships as well, as probably as a collective, especially from New Zealand's perspective, is interesting but not well known. Maybe there's a topic in there, Joe.
The Germans had some influence on the population. A lot of the sub-island families have German
surnames.
Yes. Clearly,
there's
a bit of
I think
change.
I mean, you know, well, the Schusters and the Schultzes and definitely from
I'm quite surprised that there isn't something more written about from the Southern Ireland viewpoint, having been under German administration for so many years, and then have the basically the Brits arrive or the New Zealanders arrive and take over. I mean, it's like having a country occupied and a completely different now we're looking at the world from a completely different view. Yeah. Germans over, that's what you had, and
there's
now
a lot of sensitivity, Rick. There's a huge amount of sensitivity there.
Yes.
Still today.
Oh, I think so.
I had the honour of commanding the first New Zealand troops back into Samoa 8 years after they declared their renaming. In 1985, I took a group of just under 300 back into Samoa. And again, we actually repaired the cemetery. I had a bunch of engineers and infantry and medics and dentists and what have you. And we were over there for, I was over there for nearly 4 months. And so I, you know, read the history and you all about it to find out what to experience. And yes, it's a pain in the butt place. It's bloody hot, bloody humid, disease ridden, all sorts of issues. We had Chinese businessmen riot while we were there, and, you know, all sorts of issues. But the locals, when they saw me walking in uniform from where I was living to the High Commission, felt very uneasy about it. And when you talk to them, or you go to the local Matai, the chief of the village, and have a chat with the village council. Whilst we were doing a lot of civil aid stuff, there was still that bad feeling of what happened originally in 1914-15. And then in 1929, you know, when that prince, Samoan prince, got killed in the riot, and unfortunately there were New Zealand police there that were trying to put that riot down. So, yeah, it was an interesting experience. You know, trying to keep the troops from doing what they're not supposed to do. as Peter said, you know... You have issues. I think we have more issues with the Air Force, Rick.
that caused the demise of Peter Garner.
No, Pete Bunny.
Yeah. So we did a 3-week tented camp at down by the airfield, with the A4s, an Orion, whole stack of aircraft there. I was the air component commander. And you talk about hot, it was just...
You see pictures of even the Samoans with umbrellas.
You can imagine working there. I mean, we rebuilt the hospital, we were building schools, we were sinking wells. Yeah. And in fact, with the Air Force, we had 3 Squadron. Up there with the helos to support us, and we went right throughout both Upolu and Samai, the 2 main islands, and actually resurveyed and repositioned all their trek stations up on the hilltops. And imagine doing that in the heat and everything else, and it's quite trying. Sorry, Pete, you were going to say.
Just in terms of how it's remembered too. I wasn't here in 2014, but I have seen YouTubes and television clips, and certainly even on the New Zealand news, they talked about the anniversary of it in 2014.
Yeah.
But we have there's an army officer who's been up there for a few months now, and we'd asked her, was the 110th remit at all, and there was nothing.
No, really.
Not even sure it's even covering schools and stuff now. So, but they do come back to those other two. That influenza and the malady, the Black Saturday, they're the two really.
Peter, that pilot you mentioned, was that a First World War pilot?
Second World War.
Because we had a big, a bad Catalina crash there during the Second World War. Mm-hmm. Yeah, seven killed, I think it was. Yeah.
Any other questions? I'm just
thinking somebody needs to write all this stuff up.
Do we still supply a chief of police? Up there?
No.
We did for a while, didn't we?
Yeah, we did for a while.
Just the chief, that was all, wasn't it?
Yeah, no. Totally independent. In fact, I think the guy that's there at the moment is an Australian.
Right.
That
prince, as you call him, that was killed, he's the present head of state as his descendant.
Yes, I understand. And so that's why... the families, pass on the stories and the history. And I know that when some of our troops went to some of the schools, not only to rebuild, but, put in play areas and stuff like that, and they actually went in and talked to the kids, there was a sort of a few questions asked
some
of the descendants.
One of the extended family was interviewed on New Zealand TV the other night.
Okay.
And he's hosting Prince Charles.
Oh, yes, okay. I saw that. Yes, from Ceylon.
Joe Annandale.
Yes.
Yeah. So the New Zealand police are supporting the Chorum thing.
Yes.
They
had a couple of plane loads go up there. Yeah. Yeah, it was on the news last night, I think. Any other questions? All right, well, look, thanks once again, Peter. A very interesting topic and one that's not very well known. A lot of history. I'm pleased you dug that out of our resources.
Yeah.
To thank Peter. So, once again, thank you very much.
Yeah.